I've just been asked briefly to introduce Durham, the people from Durham, and Mike Barton, the chief. This is, for me, been asked like being asked to introduce the sun rising. They sparkle and they shine and they excite us and they do wonderful things. They do indeed. And part of that is based on a very, very strong philosophy, which some others have disengaged from, of neighbourhood policing and problem solving, which is at the heart of the force. It's a spirit that engages everybody. And we've had a succession of great students here and innovation from them. And you're about to hear about one of those leading innovations today. I mean, this is a kind of, in some senses, a world first. It does give me great pleasure to introduce the sun rising, or as somebody once said of Jack Nicholson at a famous charity do, the transcendent Durham. Mike.
Thank you very much, Sir Dennis. That's very generous. My best days are definitely behind me, but they are definitely in front of Gillian. So with no more ado, and everybody will introduce themselves, but you all know Jeff, who has helped Sheena with this work, and Gillian, you were here as a student 2 or 3 years ago. And the way we've reorganised the force when austerity bit in 2010 was we moved away from an organisation that was geographically based. So we had two basic command units. We had a basic command unit at headquarters, and then an overarching resources department, and we got rid of everything. So we now only do things once. So as an organisation, we're function organised. So tasking and coordinating is the brain of the organisation. But in terms of all of those areas of responsibility, we've swept them all away and we just do things once, but we have people like Gillian who are in charge of certain bits of the process, and you'll see where we come here. Sheena is in charge of all of the outward facing bit into the criminal justice system. So all of the investigations that we complete that go into the criminal justice system, that's where Sheena's department comes in. Anyway, hopefully that will all become clear in the presentation. Gillian.
Okay, good morning everyone. It's a slightly surreal feeling for me being here. I started my time in Cambridge in 2013 when I got a very interesting phone call that is forever ingrained in my memory from my chief, Mike, who rang me, I think it was about 6 o'clock on a Friday evening just before Christmas, and said, Gillian, would you like to do a master's at Cambridge? When I'd picked myself off the floor, my journey here began, and I am immensely proud to have been part of all of this. Something else that I'm immensely proud of is Checkpoint. I'm standing here as the face of this, but Checkpoint isn't about me. Checkpoint is about a number of people in the organisation who have made this happen, and I'm shamelessly going to name check some people, particularly Andy Crowe, who is with us today. And Andy, if I get any hard questions, it's over to you, mate, I'm afraid. Kev Weir and Sheena and a number of others, John Cooper, etc., have all been involved in this. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Checkpoint and our story, about where it came from and where we are now. Would be wrong if I didn't touch on the theoretical basis, so I will give you a little bit of theory. I'll also talk about the implementation, and I have vivid memories of Sir Dennis talking to us about implementation is extremely hard, and we have had a very interesting journey around implementation with Checkpoint. I'll touch on some results, and then Mike is also very passionate about putting the public at the heart of what we do. We are here in policing for the public, so I wanted to end with a story. Peel, Sir Robert Peel, actually gave us the mission for policing, and this is the cornerstone of Checkpoint. How can we actually prevent crime and disorder and actually stop people reoffending? Three basic theories that we used in Checkpoint. The first one, deterrence, and we focus on the certainty and the speed, not the severity. The research will tell you that it's not the severity that actually drives this, it's the certainty and celerity. So that's, the speed and celerity. Desistance, why do people offend and what can we do to stop them offending? A lot of the research here has been done post-sanction. For checkpoints, we do it pre-sanction. So we actually start the interventions before they go through the criminal justice process. And finally, how do we actually get them to engage and stay with us? That's the sword of Damocles. Research question, I remember vividly setting this in my thesis and I had the pleasure of writing the protocol. So what Checkpoint actually does is test the hypothesis around a deferred prosecution to a target group of offenders around supported desistance with an individually tailored contract. So what we're interested in is, does that intervention actually work better than the criminal justice process? And that's what we tested during Checkpoint. Our initial target group in Durham, our integrated offender management cohort of offenders actually only is about 3% of all of our offending cohort. Now that's great for targeting, but what about the 97% of everyone else who gets nothing? Everyone else who actually at the time was put through the revolving door of the criminal justice process. So that's what Checkpoint actually wanted to start looking at. So where did we begin? Implementation, building on Turning Point, listening to Peter and Eleanor and everyone else in Cambridge, we wanted to build on Turning Point, but there are some real lessons around implementation, and 4 years down the line, this stuff is really hard, so when the guys here are saying implementation is hard, it truly is. For us, that coalition of common purpose is absolutely critical. Understanding what the public views are before you start this kind of thing is critical. Understanding where your resources are and where they're coming from is critical, and you actually go around this loop many, many times. The media view, I have vivid memories of driving from here 1 July when the media were saying, everyone go to Durham, it's like supermarket sweep, the offenders don't get prosecuted. This stuff is real. So when we talk about the narrative, you need to try and control the narrative. What is it you're trying to achieve and how can you actually influence that? When you talk about the structure for implementation, our implementation plan initially was 3 months. It lasted nearly 15. By the time we got a testable treatment, by the time we understood exactly what it looked like, by the time we'd sorted out all of the quality assurance and the governing board and made sure we had secure funding, this stuff takes time. Our staff, one of the biggest decisions we had to grapple with was actually how can we get our staff on board? What does it look like for them? Building on Mike's philosophy of problem orientation, we sold this as problem orientation on an industrial scale. How can we make things truly great for the people that we're trying to serve? We built on some new key skills, and we actually brought in navigators, a big decision for us, and more on navigators later, but one of the crucial differences between Turning Point and Checkpoint is the people that we use to do the intervention. We had a whole host of forms and templates to set up and tracking. You cannot underestimate the importance of tracking data. You absolutely need to know what's happening in your experiment and why. If you haven't got the data in the feedback loop, you will lose it, and we did on several occasions. You talk about who's getting the pill in a randomized control trial, what does your control sample look like, how do you know that your staff and officers are doing what you've asked them to do? All of this stuff is real. When you actually think about the final stage for learning and adaptation, when you're looking for the future and shaping the future, Checkpoint has morphed into something that I don't think Andy, Kev, Sheena and I ever dreamed it would when we first started this journey, and I'll tell you exactly where we've got to. But you need to go around this cycle many, many times when you're trying to run research and experimentation. So, one of the things that we did, we had an implementation phase where we just put everybody through Checkpoint. On the implementation phase, our entry criteria was 3 offences or less, so our offenders had to have committed 3 offences or less. We then brought in Hart, and I'm not going to steal Sheena or Jeff's thunder, but we changed the eligibility criteria. So overnight, when we moved from our implementation phase into our randomised control trial, we made it much harder for ourselves. We based it on moderate risk offenders, so the goalpost shifted. Checkpoint has since expanded. We actually included child neglect, and I remember having conversations about whether that should be in or not. We have child neglect in Checkpoint. We actually also do Checkpoint 3D because in the randomized control trial, we were leaving a whole cohort of other people who weren't no longer involved. So Checkpoint 3D looks at our voluntary attenders and first-time offenders. We were also running the randomised control trial at the same time with HART, and we've moved into domestic abuse, and we're now doing checkpoint with domestic abuse offenders. We're also doing it with our youth offending service, and we're starting to think about whether we introduce it into hate crime. So this has grown beyond belief from when we first started this stuff. I'm going to skip over this one. The key point on this one is the eligibility criteria and the navigators and the needs assessment. So we actually do a needs assessment for every single offender that comes into checkpoint, and the navigators do that. There is a critical difference between what a police officer does and what a navigator does. Navigators are actually people who come from our partner agencies. They are trained in things like brief interventions. They aren't interviewers. They are really people who will build on social control and build the bonds with these people. The guy on the left is one of our police officers. The guy on the right is a guy who works for us, and he's an ex-drug addict. He's one of our navigators, and he does an absolutely amazing job. When you actually think about results from checkpoint, this is our implementation phase. So when we were actually on implementation, like everything, we tracked them and we had some leakage. So 15% of our offenders actually got into checkpoint with four or more offences. This is the implementation phase. 55% had no offending history, and around 30% had one or more offences. When you actually look at how can we determine whether this works, at this point we had no control group. So what we did was actually backtrack to a phase of offenders that were going through an out-of-court disposal. So checkpoint can only be delivered to offenders where a police disposal is possible. So it's not court processes, it's where the police make the decision. When we tried to compare that with a cohort of out-of-court disposal offenders as a proxy control group, and I recognise it's not a true control group, and you start comparing results, this is the kind of things that we see. So this is our checkpoint implementation phase. The light blue is your normal cohort offenders who would have the out-of-court disposals. The darker blue is our checkpoint implementation phase. There were over 500 offenders in this phase, 500 suspects. The dark black line is the four-month contract. So we hold them on a contract for 4 months, and we measure their re-arrest and their re-offending rate after it. This is a year after checkpoint. The difference in these is around about 18%. So they are rearrested fewer times. They're still rearrested, but they're rearrested fewer times. They also reoffend fewer times. Now, if you ask me if this is statistically significant, it isn't, but the results are extremely promising, and the differences in our two cohorts just in our implementation phase is really great. You start to look at our needs assessment pre and post. This is a star assessment by the offenders. The blue is the needs assessment before they entered into checkpoint. So the needs that we assess are things like accommodation, mental health, finances, substance misuse, alcohol misuse, all against an evidence base. So we do the Warwick Edinburgh Mental Health Score. We use the alcohol audit tool. So again, there is an evidence base for all of this. Significant reductions in their self-assessed needs assessment before and after they've gone through checkpoint. Again, all very promising results. So the RCT. We stopped our randomised control trial, I think the end of April this year, with John Cooper desperate to get all of the cases through. And these are the early findings in relation to our randomised control trial. Again, the blue line is days, so they held onto a checkpoint contract for 4 months. The orange line is our, and there's a slight difference here, the orange line is actually per protocol. So these are the people who actually went onto checkpoint and received the treatment. Most people will say you actually need to do an intention to treat sample. The solid line is our intention to treat. The black line is our control group. So you would say there is no difference between checkpoint and between our control group. In reality, when you look at the per protocol and the dropout rates, that for me is really interesting. So we're starting to see some real differences between, and it's early days, we need to wait another 18 months at least to see whether checkpoint works. But early days, if we can hold them on the contract, then the results are really promising. We see a reduction in offending. Domestic abuse. This is the beginnings of our checkpoint domestic abuse. We've been running this for about 12 months. When we start to look at the pre and post offending when they go for an intervention, the re-offending rate for our domestic abuse cohort, again, is quite small. The top orange line is actually if they commit any offence. So this is a domestic abuse offence or any other offence, pre and post. The re-offending rate is around about 18%. When you actually look at whether they've been, sorry, that's arrest, the solid orange line. The dotted orange line is a re-offence rate for anything. The bottom lines are where they start to re-offend. So they're getting re-arrested for various things, but they aren't necessarily re-offending. Again, this is really promising. In conclusion, early days, can we absolutely say that Checkpoint works? Based on the findings so far, Kev Weir and I joke about this, and so do Andy and I, the results are extremely promising. Our officers truly believe that Checkpoint works. They've had some interesting mischief with our implementation, putting people through treatment and control, and randomised control trials are really difficult. You absolutely need to make sure that your staff are on board. There's been some real interesting conversations with the MOJ. I'm not going to steal Andy's thunder because Andy's worked really hard with the MOJ, with Peter Nerud et al. But observations so far, implementation is hard, but Checkpoint is really, really promising. Exciting times in Durham. I said I'd end with a story. This is the same person. These two pictures are the same person. She actually came into Checkpoint as a domestic abuse offender. She was arrested. She had drug addiction problems. She was actually referred to the Magistrates Court, and the Magistrates Court sent her back to us to be treated through Checkpoint. She hasn't reoffended. There's a story behind each individual who goes through Checkpoint, and the majority, over 90% are held on the contract. The majority are really positive. So we want to make a difference for the public, and we made a difference for her and many others. Thank you.
One or two thoughts. I tend to be quite laissez-faire and democratic as a chief when we're going through our thinking phase. And so I was probably just a bit too laissez-faire when Gillian kept coming, I just want to do this with the, I just want to do this. And so when she referred to the medium risk offenders, we should have just kept all offenders in our randomised control trial. I'm absolutely certain of that now. And then we would have got our throughput a lot easier. I had to stop the randomised control trial because I was getting people coming from my organisation who were saying, this is not fair. We've got this person here who deserves to go through the Checkpoint programme, but the randomiser is saying that they've got to go to court. So when you're leading an organisation, you've got to make sure that you've got the hearts and minds of everybody in the organisation working with you. So I made a mistake by being a bit too laissez-faire with the randomised control trial. That's definitely for certain. But when you look at all of those results, one of the things that we pride ourselves on in the organisation is our efficiency, our productivity. And it, on average, we're looking at about 9 hours contact time with anybody in that four-month Checkpoint programme. 9 hours, the navigators have contact time. If I prosecute people, and because of the way the magistrates and the Crown Court works, generally, officers have to go to court, and officers in the room will recognise this, you go to court and you sit around for 7, 8, 9 hours, sometimes for more than one day. And then generally you don't have to give evidence. So for me, even just looking at the efficiency, let alone the milk of human kindness element to Checkpoint, it makes absolute sense not to prosecute people who are constantly churning through the magistrates, the revolving door of justice. It makes much more sense to have a treatment plan to deal with a person's offending as a public health problem rather than criminal justice matter. One of the problems with treating people like that is I'm doing Sheena out of a job because there are going to be fewer and fewer cases to prosecute, but Sheena will tell you about that now. Sheena.
Okay, good morning, everybody. I hope you're still awake after your evening last night. I just thought that might wake everybody up this morning. Okay, this, as understated as ever, this presentation will be data light. Last year I presented quite a bit of data from the independent validation that I completed in relation to the harm assessment risk tool. And Jeff Barnes coming on after me will satisfy any appetite for data, I'm sure, when I finish this presentation. So what is HART? The Harm Assessment Risk Tool forecasts reoffending over a two-year period in a high-risk way, moderate and low-risk way. High risk being likely to commit an offence, a serious offence over the next 2 years, moderate risk, a non-serious offence over the next 2 years, and low risk, no offence over the next 2 years. My thesis was an independent validation of that, and also we looked at how it would compare to human judgment and some of those figures Jeff will refer to in his presentation. I'll touch on the public debate. That's probably the bit that I'm going to major on this time, and supportive leadership. I was asked to sort of tell the story of what's happened in the last year, and so that's what the presentation will look like. Unfinished business being the first point. So way back in April, May 2016, I was doing my lit review, and it was obvious to me from the reading that I was doing that there would be some difficulties around the ethical issues regarding the use of big data, particularly on an individual level. However, Jeff quite rightly pointed out to me that my thesis was only 18,000 words long, and it was supposed to be an independent validation. So I managed to get a couple of hundred words in about ethics, the ethical issues caused by these kinds of models. And on the 12th of December 2016, heaved a sigh of relief and pressed submit on my thesis and enjoyed Christmas. I had no idea what 2017, what would lie ahead in 2017 or indeed 2018 at that point. We needed to, in terms of unfinished business, we needed to address that ethical issue, as Gillian highlighted in her presentation. It's really important to us in Durham. We are the public are the police, and we needed to hear from the public how they felt about the use of these kinds of tools. I could not see a reason why this shouldn't go into the public domain to build trust. We need to be open and transparent. Where we can be, we should be. And with these kind of models, there will be occasions where the police can't be. Where we can be, we should be. I was put in touch with Marion Oswald from Winchester University by Peter Nayrud, and had a really good conversation with her and developed a framework, legal ethical framework, called AlgoCare, which essentially captures the lessons that we've learned along the way. Also involved in that was a chap called Jamie Grace, whose specialism is law, from Sheffield University. And we've since published a paper in relation to that in the Information Communication Technology and the Law Journal. When we were going into the public domain for the first time, I was quite nervous about it. And for those that remember the presentation last year, within around 2 days of going into the public domain for the first time, it got some attention, swiftly followed by a number of Freedom of Information requests and attention from civil liberty groups. So the public debate, coincidentally, when we went into the public domain, coincidentally, there was an inquiry launched, Commons Select Committee, Inquiry Science and Technology Committee, into algorithms in decision making. Swiftly followed by a Lords inquiry into AI, artificial intelligence more generally, and I made the choice to go ahead and submit evidence to both. I submitted one piece of evidence with Jeff into the Commons Committee and another with Marion Oswald into the Commons Committee, and then submitted a separate one with Marion into the Lords Committee. Both of these submissions are in the public domain too. And in the submissions, I was asking for more regulation around these issues, having read more into the ethical issues and the openness and the need for openness and transparency. More regulation to protect citizens, but also to provide them with reassurance. A year to the day after pressing send on the thesis, I was at Commons Select Committee, having been called to give oral evidence to them about the harm assessment risk tool. They suggested that I might want to be there to hear the evidence in the session before mine. There was 2-hour-long sessions, and they suggested I sit through it in case any questions came from that. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, it wasn't my best idea to watch that because I watched Twitter, Microsoft, Google and Experian get a pretty hard time just before I was about to give evidence, so not my best idea. But it was a fantastic experience, and the Lord's report has been published called AI in the UK, Ready, Willing and Able, and there is a debate timetabled. It recognises the transformational potential and how important transformation potential is, but also highlights the need to address the concerns and the risks associated with it. The Office of Artificial Intelligence, the Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation and the Artificial Intelligence Council will play a significant role in going forward with that. The Commons report is out also, again, the government have around 2 months to respond to that. Media. We've had a funny relationship with the media over the last 18 months. I think initially it was really difficult for some parts of the media to get their heads around, so I'll only briefly touch on it by saying this. I can't teach a journalist in a 5-minute interview about policing, about the harm assessment risk tool, about the independent validation, and about how seriously we've taken the ethical considerations in the same way that a journalist can't teach me journalism in 5 minutes, and that probably sums it up. I think we've got a bit better in the last few months. We've done a click documentary, which some of you may have seen, and we've had some really positive articles put out there. Citizens' jury. The citizens' jury was something I was asked to present hard at by the Royal Society and Google DeepMind. And I felt that it was a really good opportunity to speak directly to citizens rather than them understand artificial intelligence or machine learning through Minority Report or some of the headlines that you see about Durham Constabulary deciding if somebody's in custody or on bail according to a risk factor. It was a really good opportunity to speak to citizens. There were 4 juries, so I did go down for it. And it wasn't wasted on me on the way down there when I realised, as a head of criminal justice, what if they find me guilty? What happens then? But when I got there, there was 4 juries, and it was a representative sample. It's a piece of research that the Royal Society were doing. The night before I went in there, the Amnesty International report on the gang matrix had come out, and the first jury, the first 2 questions related to the gang matrix because they thought that Heart was the same or the gang matrix was the same as the harm assessment risk tool. But again, a really interesting day. That report has been published and is entitled Artificial Intelligence, Real Public Engagement. And what I found there and have found elsewhere is when you actually speak directly to members of the public about what you're doing and why you're doing it, they're largely supportive. You wouldn't think that with some of the reports that we see, but largely supportive. We've taken part in other research at RUSI in London, and also building networks is really important. Really important for me. I've attended various meetings across the UK and in conferences in different countries too, and they help enormously to create networks and mean that you can start to anticipate issues and challenges that may occur. There is a real desire to build better networks, not just across the UK in policing, but across countries. No one force can do everything in relation to this stuff. Technology is moving too fast, and my view is no one country can either. Various different countries, Spain in particular, they had a predictive policing meeting, and there is a real desire to join networks up, and there's no reason why the UK shouldn't be leading the way with that. Challenges. You've probably already guessed I have had some challenges around civil liberty groups, media, data protection impact assessments and freedom of information. Civil liberty groups, I think it's absolutely right that they check and challenge. It's right and proper they check and challenge. They offer us a bit of balance. However, they can create an enormous amount of work in terms of freedom of information requests. And I have to say that those requests could have been a job all of their own in Durham as we've gone through this. I think it can be frustrating at times, and I think the latest, the last press release from Big Brother Watch is an example of how frustrating that can be. That said, I think because of how seriously we've taken those ethical challenges and the work that we've done around AlgoCare has meant we're in a good position through talking to the ICO. The data impact assessments with the advent of GDPR now means that we it's mandatory to comply with these. It was discretionary before. They're not simple documents. They're not easy documents to write. But I think because of the public engagement that we've done with external ethics committees, citizens juries, we've put ourselves in a stronger position. Implementation's hard. I'm echoing what Gillian has said. You're doing things for the right reasons, but you have to listen to the other side of the argument and never underestimate the size of those ethical issues. Doing something for the first time's hard, which is why it's so important. And everybody is great at telling you how it should have been done. And that's the reason we addressed AlgoCare, to try and capture those lessons learned. But when you've got this hindsight going on, 2020 vision, supportive leadership at all levels is really important. You need to know that you are supported. And I just want to highlight a couple of things. It doesn't have to be something hugely significant to make a difference and give you the confidence to carry on with it in the face of those challenges. So I'll just give a couple of little examples of supportive leadership. When I first went into the public domain in April last year with this, I was very nervous. I knew there would be civil liberty groups. I knew there could be some challenges for us. And the chief happened to walk past me one day and said, "Hi, are you all right?" And I said, for the first time, "No, not really. I'm not." And he said, "What's the matter?" And he sat down, and it was 5 minutes, 10 minutes at most. And that's all it took to give me the confidence to go into that conference and know that the organisation and the head of the organisation supported me. This is Deputy Chief Constable Joe Farrell. When I found out I'd been called to give oral evidence to the Select Committee, I was on a train the next day going to a meeting with DCC Farrell, and so she happened to be the first person I mentioned it to, after a bit of a sleepless night. And she thought it was fantastic news and said, "Have a think about it and just tell me whatever you need. Whatever you need, we'll sort it out." And again, just that little bit of supportive leadership. Didn't take long to know that I was supportive. Also, when going to the Select Committee, these two chaps, Peter Nayrood and Sir Dennis, I emailed to say, "Have you got any advice?" And again, in a couple of lines, that's all it takes. It doesn't take much time. A couple of lines, really, really supportive. And this guy helped a little bit too, Jeff Barnes, particularly when we were grappling with some of the difficult freedom of information requests. So if you've got colleagues or staff who are going through their research and it's challenging and it's difficult and it's been done for the first time, it doesn't take much. It's little things to make a difference, to give confidence, support and freedom to innovate in your force. So take that few minutes. It means a lot. What next? We've just taken delivery of Model B for the harm assessment risk tool, and some analysis of that will be going on. We are awaiting the outcome of the human judgment versus heart, and I think Jeff will be talking about that. And obviously there's the Hampshire model, domestic abuse model, that's also being built. The joined up network for me is a really important point. There's some fantastic work going on in Germany, going on in Spain, going on in the US around this stuff. We need to be better connected with that from a law enforcement point of view. And I suppose the last thing I want to say is data quality is really important with these things. However, ethically and morally is where the debate is when it comes to using them practically in policing. Thank you.
Okay, so I have to go through this really, really fast. So what were we predicting? Sheen already said this. We were predicting people that were three groups. So the serious group is people that committed one of these six offenses listed down at the bottom. So that was 11.2% actually do that in 2 years. The yellow group, the second group, is moderates. They commit any other offense within 2 years. When you add those two groups together, it's about 60% of everybody will reoffend in Durham within 2 years of being arrested. These are the things that were used in Model A, but we got rid of one of them. You've already heard, we took out one predictor. Generally, these people look like, if you look at the three groups and you say, well, what do they look like? Use the predictors that are used to build the model. You see, it kind of goes along with what you would think. The highest risk people generally tend to be younger. They tend to have onset earlier in their life. They've reoffended in the more recent past. They have far more prior offenses. They have far more prior violent offenses. But then the story gets a little bit more complicated. When you start talking about, well, how many prior drug offenses they have, you have that actually peaks in the moderate group, and this sort of makes sense. If you're addicted to drugs, you need to commit acquisitive crime to support that habit. And then I just wanted to put two other predictors up there, which is, this is what we typically focus on in criminal justice. What did you do today to get brought into custody? What is your incident offense? And in general, the incident offense doesn't really tend to be all that great of a predictor, and you can sort of see how the way these three bars are flat. All right, so this is the new part. Took a look at people just this morning, and we looked at how they are, what kind of trajectories they have. So the model predicts either they're high, moderate, or low risk. So the red line is the high risk, and this is just what percent have onset with offending. Now remember, this is a 2-year model. We're predicting out to 2 years, and you can see that that'll be 24 months. We can't yet see the end of this yet. We're probably going to need another year to get solid information on what they look like at the 2-year point. But the model is doing a good job at identifying the high and moderates, and identifying that they're going to offend. A little bit, we are asking the sergeants, or we were asking the sergeants, to make their own predictions. I'm here to tell you today that at least when it comes to moderate risk, Durham custody sergeants are doing an excellent job, and they're actually slightly above the model. It must be their leadership. So they are doing better when it comes to making moderate risk predictions. You can see that dotted line is just a little bit above the yellow. Now that's the yellow line. What about the red? Well, the red's not such a good story. The model makes its forecast. The custody sergeants are making their forecast, but they are way underneath the amount of offending that's taking place that's predicted by the model. And when it comes to the low risk forecast, it's the opposite story, but it's also not such a happy story, because the low risk forecast, none of these people should be offending. Both the model and the sergeants are wrong on this graph, but the sergeants are wrong just a little bit more often. Now we move into serious offending. So again, I got to give the Durham sergeants credit. When they make a moderate risk forecast, they are basically matching the model and predicting serious offending. That is very good. The red and the blues, we had the same kind of story. There still needs to be more time for this data to firm up, but that's sort of where things are looking. We have a lot more information than we had a year ago. And that's really all I have time for, except you'll see this slide later on. Just to stop to say that these models are really cool, and you might be thinking, gosh, I want one, I want to build one. But before you build one, decide what you're going to do with the forecast. You need to know how you're going to respond when something's high. Just because you can build it doesn't mean you should. And that's it. Is that 5 minutes?